the coming week. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund hold their fall meetings. The Czech Republic holds closely watched general elections, and the Group of 20 has an emergency summit on Afghanistan. It's October 7, 2021, in time for the world next week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, it's that time of year for the annual autumn meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. They are both taking place in Washington, D.C., as well as virtually, which is kind of the new norm these days in major meetings. They are going to be the sort of typical gathering of sort of the top central bankers, ministers of finance, ministers of development. You get private sector executives and so forth. These meetings usually capture the zeitgeist in some way about how the world is feeling, either upbeat or funky about the state of things. So, Jim, can you tell us what's going to be on the agenda this fall?
I suspect, Bob, that the discussion that's going to be taking place next week is going to be about the storm clouds that are on the global economic horizon. Now, we've had a rough couple of years because of COVID-19. The world economy contracted by 3%, but that was on average. Many countries experienced much bigger recessions, and that's particularly true of poorer countries. Now, of course, there's been a hope that 2021 would be a big breakout year. And the IMF predicted near the start of the year that we would see something in the order of 6% growth as the global economy came bouncing back from COVID. However, I think the IMF recently has sort of scaled back its predictions, saying that we're not likely to get to 6%. And again, that's an overall number, a global average, and it's heavily affected by a few big countries like China. The reality is, as the managing director of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, said that for many countries, probably the majority of emerging and developing countries, that they won't recover from the downturn triggered by COVID for many more years. As the conversations begin at these meetings, a lot of focus is going to be on some global challenges. Obviously, the one topping that is COVID, what's happening with the Delta variant, the potential emergence of other variants, how that is disrupting supply chains, big questions about how efficacious the efforts have been to get vaccines outside of the advanced industrialized economies and getting it into much of the rest of the world. So there's that set of issues. There's also going to be a lot of talk about inflation. One of the things we have seen over the past 6 or 8 months as economies around the world have started to pick up after the initial setback caused by COVID is that demand is outpacing supply. We talked just last week, Bob, about a spike in energy prices. It's a lot of concern about whether inflation is going to take hold on a more permanent basis. That's one of the big debates occurring right now among economists and in financial circles. Are the price spikes that we're seeing temporary, or are they going to be with us for the longer term? And of course, if they are, that brings back bad memories of the late 70s, early 80s, where global inflation was quite high. The other big macro issue is rising public debt. One of the things we saw across the world, particularly in the United States, but not solely in the United States, when COVID hit, was governments spent a lot of money to keep their economies going. Now, it's easy enough for governments to put spending on the credit card, so to speak, but eventually you got to pay the bill for that. And there's a lot of talk about how and when central banks are going to return to more normal policies and sort of go back to a less loose money environment than we have experienced over the last 18 months or so. And indeed, some speculation that central banks may move sooner rather than later to tighten the money supply precisely because of inflation fears. Besides those global macro concerns, I think there are really two other country-specific problems that people are going to be talking about at these meetings, Bob. One is the potential rupture of China's ailing real estate sector, seen most vividly in what appears to be the collapse of the real estate giant Evergrande. People worry that if the collapse of Evergrande is not handled properly, it could disrupt the Chinese economy. And again, given the importance of the Chinese economy to the global economy, the ripple effects will be immense. I think the other issue people are worried about is the U.S. debt ceiling confrontation. This is what the economist called America's ritualistic threats of economic self-harm, which I don't think is much of an exaggeration. And again, the fear here is that the United States will default on its debt, and that would have just a massive impact on the global economy. Now, as we're sitting down to tape the podcast, news news broke that it appears that senators have reached an agreement for a short-term lifting of the debt ceiling, but that merely postpones the problem, Bob, from here in October to what likely be another confrontation in December. So that issue, at least at last word, doesn't look to be going away for good.
Jim, a lot to parse through there, but I think you kind of seized on the big issues. You could also talk about whether or not there's going to be any sort of attention paid to a recent sort of scandal with the World Bank in terms of how it was potentially favoring China in its doing business surveys, things like that. But I do think a central issue, especially given that these meetings take place in Washington, is that sense of what is going on in the host nation. And it's obviously default is a huge thing, but it's also how is this country able to govern itself? I mean, I think the world would feel a lot better if you had a country that was showing a little bit more cohesion and even bipartisanship in some of the big issues, passing legislation that will help set a template for potential climate change policy, for example, continuing to propel an effort potentially to really get out into the world vaccine supplies, which came up at a U.S.-hosted summit. It's come up at a lot of the major international fora of recent months, but yet it still seems like the U.S. is kind of mired in these domestic problems. And I would imagine that this gathering in Washington will be an opportunity for the people coming or even those just meeting in virtual hallways to talk more about what is going on.
Oh, you're no doubt right, Bob. And I think that, you know, there are great concerns around the world about the competence of the United States and whether the United States can get things done. We've talked about this before in the podcast. The Biden administration is fond of talking about how America is back. But I think for people in many foreign capitals, the America that is back is not one that they recognize. It is no longer the can-do country. And they worry that the United States is a country that has effectively become dysfunctional. And again, I can't think of anybody, Democrat or Republican, who looks at our current decision-making process for deciding budgets and says that is a process that people should emulate. And it's a real problem because it gets back to the broader issue of the United States says it is going to do something or the president says he is going to do something on behalf of the United States. Can he actually follow through? And a lot of the signs are troubling. And it's not just big macro things. It's on issues like uptake of vaccines. You look at the United States. And we're very fortunate here. Companies like Pfizer and Moderna, Johnson & Johnson produce these vaccines. They're highly effective. And initially, the United States had really good numbers in terms of vaccine uptake. We were leading the world. And now we're falling behind. And the whole issue of whether or not to get a vaccine has become a big political issue in the United States in a way it hasn't anywhere else. And so, you know, this is going to be with us for as long as American politics is dysfunctional. People having conversations about whether or not the United States can deliver on what it needs to deliver on. Now, the big cautionary tale here, of course, is that people may be dismayed by what they're seeing happening in Washington, D.C., but for most of America's traditional friends, partners, and allies, there's no other horse to ride. It's like they're upset. They'd like to see a different kind of America, return to America that functioned more smoothly, where you saw more bipartisan cooperation, where you didn't seemingly every year or so have some sort of death-defying political confrontation. But that's not what they have right now. But something beats nothing.
Yes. And again, with Washington as the host, it gives it a chance to put up a good face and remind people that this fall meeting is not being based in China, the other great economic and rising global power.
And also, I think, Bob, just to close this out, it's important to note that these meetings at the IMF and the World Bank aren't going to make big policy changes. The real action remains, as we just discussed, in national capitals, particularly in the most important countries politically and economically. Obviously, China and the United States leading that list.
Yeah. And as we were taping this podcast, new reports about plans for a Xi-Biden summit and what seemed to be really intensified efforts to hold talks on a whole host of issues that are dividing U.S.-China. So that's something to keep an eye on.
We'll talk a lot about that virtual bilateral summit, Bob, a bit closer to when it happens. For now, let's shift our gears and talk about the Czech Republic. Czechs are set to go to the polls on October 8th and 9th to vote in parliamentary elections. In addition to the usual domestic and foreign policy issues that come up in any campaign. The Czech election is potentially going to be influenced by a whole new issue. That is the release of the Pandora Papers. They were released earlier this week, and they contain something on the order of 12 million confidential documents. Among them were materials suggesting that Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš and several other heads of states and billionaires are using offshore companies with little or no transparency to salt away money. Now, Prime Minister Babiš remains the election front runner. Polls show that Prime Minister Babiš's party remains the election front runner with an estimated 27% support. But tell us a bit more, Bob. What's going on in the Czech Republic? And do you think that the Pandora Papers are going to make a difference?
Really important question. The timing of these papers, by the way, have Prime Minister Babiš, his enemies are staging a massive disinformation campaign. But we'll get back to that in a second, Jim. First, I would just say that like so many other elections that we've talked about seemingly recently, especially in sort of the Western democratic model, you have a template here. You have a populist party that is either in control or rising or threatening to ascend to the leadership. You have center-right coalitions. You have center-left coalitions. You have parties that are dug in on the fringes, the Blood and Soil Nationalist Party, or in the case of the Eastern European variety, you tend to have vestiges of communist parties that are still sticking around, especially with older voters. Basically, all recipe for a very divided country. The polls that you mentioned show a Czech Republic that, like many others, is divided. Babiš is a very interesting figure, you know, as billionaires from this part of the world tend to be. He has come out and rather vigorously sought to defend his financial practices and basically said he did nothing, you know, untoward. But the charges are tending to stick to him in part because he has campaigned. He's sort of hung his political flag on being an anti-corruption straight shooter, and yet continues to be dogged by sort of illicit financial dealings that have contributed to him being a billionaire. That's the charge, at least. It should be noted he's faced at least two major demonstrations, sort of anti-government, anti-Babiš demonstrations, and sort of survived them in the polling. Earlier this year, when the polling first started ramping up in the springtime, let's say, or late spring, he was seen as trailing one of the other major coalitions. And this is the sort of colorful sounding Pirates and Mayors coalition. This is the center left, more to the left, I guess we should say, progressive coalition. And that was at a time when the country was really lagging on the vaccine front. The Czech Republic, like so many others, has been hit hard by COVID, but really particularly hard. At one point, actually, one of the highest per capita fatality rates, 30,000 or so Czechs have died. This is a country of 10 million people. So that's a pretty high percentage. And there was a period where they seemed to be really scrambling to stave off the infection rates and to acquire vaccines. They have rallied. They have since ramped things up since then. And with that, you have seen Babiš's polling figures rise from the low 20s to what you said, about 27% for his party known as ANO, A-N-O, which means yes in the Czech language. You have these two other major coalitions that have been talking about making common cause. One is the Pirate and Mayors coalition, and the other is a clustering of three more conservative parties that are called SPOLU, which means together. They're in the ballpark of 20% each. The thinking being that holds through the elections, Jim, and they are able to latch onto a couple of smaller parties. They can achieve a proper governing coalition. However, the president, Miloš Zeman, who has already sort of thrown his support behind Babiš and said if his polling numbers show through and he gets the 27 or so percent as the lead party, he will give him the first option to form a government, and making signals that seem to sound like he sort of would tip the scales in favor of whatever Babiš comes up with in terms of trying to form a government. So we're heading for a very interesting weekend in the Czech Republic. This, like other countries in the neighborhood, has been dealing with issues also involving resentment in some sectors towards the European Union and in sort of its entangling policies, although the Czech Republic, like other countries in the region, has benefited from EU largesse. Also, the migration or the immigration topic has been a big one. It should be noted Babiš has started to make a lot of comments about sort of speaking out against migrants overcoming and overwhelming the country. He's using some language that we've heard from Viktor Orban in Hungary. And so it's another sort of litmus test for a country that was in the vanguard of the early EU, early NATO countries, sort of taking a test of its temperature and whether or not the populace is sort of more oriented towards this Western orientation, the EU and NATO oriented, or more sort of going its own path and choosing the illiberal democracy path of Hungary.
Bob, earlier in your career, you spent a lot of time in Prague. Can you give us a sense from your perspective why you think there is this debate in the Czech Republic?
Yes, Jim. It's a debate that it makes sense. And it's also made sense, by the way, in Poland and Hungary as well, in which you had this rush towards the embrace of the big Western organizations, the EU and NATO. NATO because they wanted to get out of the orbit of the Soviet Union and Russia in particular. And EU because the EU was going to be this tide that lifted all boats. It was going to be getting these countries into the 21st century with new infrastructure, with the promise of investment coming into the country, but also jobs opening up across the continent. And so you did have in the Czech Republic, as you had in other countries, a number of people who were especially warm-minded towards the West leaving the country. And what you had left were the people who were resenting, not a huge amount, certainly not as large maybe as in Hungary, but still a number of people who had been resenting the swift change and change to what they saw as sort of their country's personality, really, towards this alignment of European Union values and everything that involves in terms of also Brussels dictating things like migration policy and so forth. So you do have this kind of sentiment that was common for the region. The Czechs have moved less strongly in this direction of populism, nationalism. It's there, and certainly Babiš reflects that. But there's also the strong resonance, what I would say is the sort of the Havel aspect of the Czech Republic. Václav Havel representing this incredibly strong moral stature and somebody who reflected the Czech independence, but also the desire for freedom. And it's also a country, we should note, going back to the 1930s, you had the Czech Republic was a vigorous, or then Czechoslovakia, was a vigorous democracy, one of the 10 largest economies in the world as well. And it dealt with the double trauma of Nazism and Soviet communism. There's a whole bunch of these things going through the country right now, Jim. And I think there are strong elements on all sides. I mentioned the communists. When I was living there in the 90s, it still was a surprise to a lot of people how strong the former communists were. And would poll consistently in enough, a high enough level to have representatives and to be sometimes courted by parties in power in the 90s, Jim. So they're still around. They are much smaller, though. This nationalistic sentiment is something more ascendant. And so I think it's going to be yet, as I said, another litmus test for how is Central Europe, how does it see itself? How does the Czech Republic see itself sort of thriving going forward? Slovakia, from which the Czechs had what was called the Velvet Divorce 30 or so years ago, Jim, they were also struggling with a lot of these issues, but have tended to move more towards Western orientation. We'll have to see what happens with the Czechs.
Bob, we began our conversation by noting that the release of the Pandora Papers has thrown a potential curveball into the Czech elections. And I don't want to end this conversation without actually going back to the Pandora Papers. What do you make of their release, their political significance, particularly for the United States? One of the most interesting things I saw, at least in the release of the documents, was how people outside the United States are using secrecy laws in shell companies in the United States to park their money. And a lot has been talked about traditionally Delaware having relatively lax rules or robust rules, depending on how you want to frame it, in terms of the ability to place money with it not being clear as to who owns it. But I was surprised to see South Dakota now has emerged as a new place to park your money. So what are your thoughts on all of that?
I think that's a really important takeaway, Jim. For me, one of the more intriguing ones, actually. It's not so surprising to see some of the names on the list of lead current or former leaders who were taking advantage of shell companies. But yeah, the state of South Dakota, upwards of $300 billion of these types of investments going in with the approval of South Dakota law and South Dakota officialdom. It's the way states assert control over their affairs. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of pressure come from either within or without in terms of South Dakota changing any laws like that. But even, you had the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, with purchases in California and in Washington, D.C. of major properties, multi-million dollar properties that were done in sort of non-transparent ways, although he's defended his right to use his own money to do so. The Czech prime minister, one of the things that got a lot of attention was a lavish chateau in France. So again, his money going into an investment in a French chateau. We're seeing these things taking place, not in sort of remote areas, but in Western countries with seemingly strong laws about laundering money. But yet this latest set of revelations is showing that there's people with a lot of money have lots of options to move that money around and protect it.
This poses some very interesting challenges for the Biden administration, Bob. As you know, one of the planks of American foreign policy has been to cut down on corruption because it is linked to all kinds of other bad behaviors around the globe. But as we see for the United States federal government, it can be difficult to actually address or tackle the illicit illicit flow of money, in part because here in the United States, we have federalism and states can have their own laws and the governor or legislature of South Dakota or any other state doesn't have to craft their financial transparency laws in ways that please the nation's capital.
You know, the other thing that will be worth watching is whether you have maybe a growing number of U.S. states who look at South Dakota saying, wow, they're doing quite well in this arena. You know, maybe we can get a piece of that action too. So
the old-fashioned race to the bottom.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Jim, I want to take our discussion partway across the European continent to Italy, where the group of 20 under the rotating presidency of Italy is scheduled to hold an emergency meeting on Afghanistan. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has recently discussed Afghanistan with a number of world leaders, including Russia's Vladimir Putin and China's Xi Jinping. He's trying to organize a special set of meetings to provide some strategies to confront the crisis in Afghanistan, which, as you've noted on this podcast before, is, among other things, an economic one, a looming economic one, given its dependence on aid. So, Jim, can you tell us what we need to know before this special meeting?
Sure, Bob. I think that Prime Minister Draghi is essentially trying to create a square circle. He is trying to get various powers to come to an agreement on an aid package for Afghanistan that would simultaneously alleviate the human suffering that we're witnessing in Afghanistan while preventing terrorism and human rights abuses from taking root in the country. And again, that's a pretty tall order. On the one hand, you have to keep in mind that Afghanistan, up until the time the Taliban came to power, essentially depended upon flows of external aid in order to operate. Something on the order of 75% of the expenditures of the Afghan government came from foreign aid. Once the Taliban took over, outside countries, the United States, many others, turned off the financing tap. The United States also closed down and froze the assets of the Afghanistan government overseas. Now, this obviously creates a big problem in Afghanistan because its main source for its economy comes to a screeching halt. Now, of course, we were told, at least the Taliban told us, it was a new kind of Taliban, different from the old kind of the Taliban. But I would say after about a month or so, the new boss looks a lot like the old boss, to paraphrase an old Who song. We have seen the Taliban appoint an interim government, and I'll put interim in quotation marks, that consists only of men and made up pretty much only of members of the Taliban. Girls have been banned from education past the sixth grade. Women have been banned from studying or teaching at public universities. Taliban authorities have imposed sweeping restrictions on media and free speech. So looking at all of this, the concern is that the Taliban is simply a replay of the Taliban we saw in the 1990s. And that was a government that allowed terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda to flourish. And so countries like the United States, Britain, and the countries in the EU are not inclined to provide financial aid to a government that they worry, for good cause, is going to pose a threat to them and their citizens.
Yeah, I mean, even if you set aside the lack of diversity or gender diversity, especially, this is not a government of technocrats. So these are people who are, you know, hardened fighters. They're very good at that. They're very good at what they've done, and actually extraordinarily good in terms of ultimately defeating one of the most powerful military alliances in history. And yet they are there standing around with their hands up, seemingly, as they try to deal with governing a country of 30 million. And, you know, even if you opened up the aid sluice gates, it's not clear how that in fact would work, how effectively it could be distributed. How does the poor farmer in Helmand province get what he needs, or, you know, some of the city services in places like Herat in the west and Mazar-i-Sharif in the north get what they need? It is a massive problem. I think, as in the past, even in the previous Taliban regime, there will be a turning to the UN to try to step in and do what they can, working with local nationals, but sometimes UN staff that are permitted to come in. But it's the, you know, sort of the odiousness of what seem to be the many elements of this regime that's going to make it really hard for even the most well-minded, you know, G20 countries to kind of make a difference. I mean, it just feels like it's just a giant disaster looming.
It is a giant disaster that is looming on the horizon because we're moving toward winter and it's going to be colder, harder to move things around. And again, I think from the vantage point of Western countries, there is a segment of government officials that are looking at the situation right now, very worried about the humanitarian disaster that is here and is only going to get worse. And what they're hoping to do is to use the prospect of aid as leverage leverage to get the Taliban to cooperate on a range of issues. Now, of course, you point out it may be the case, even if the Taliban agreed to do things, they don't have the technical competence to actually carry anything out. But one line of thinking is what we should do is, in essence, hold this out as essentially as a carrot to get what we want. There's another segment of thinking which argues that the Taliban are weak and they're vulnerable and that no aid should be given to them because then the people of Afghanistan will turn on the Taliban and they will be forced out of power. And then we will have the conditions for a possible movement toward a better, more representative government in Afghanistan. Think of this as the we should expect short-term pain, but that will give us a long-term gain. And I think those arguments are going back and forth. And of course, you get the experts in and they can argue which way in that as to which strategy is most likely to work.
And the G20 will be interesting also because you have in that grouping countries that border Afghanistan that are interested in it, not only as a, for broader humanitarian reasons, but for regional stability reasons. So read China, for example. And so it will be interesting to see what kind of approaches they might bring to bear to help stabilize the situation.
Certainly. And I do think, you know, the Chinese, to give one example, have at least talked about providing support to the Taliban. Chinese officials have been calling on Western powers to end their sort of freeze or halt on transaction with the Taliban. But I should also note that the Biden administration is trying to avoid having a policy that is entirely just say no to the Taliban. And they have come up with a variety of licenses that are designed to allow at least a minimal flow of aid, usually in the form of NGOs and other organizations, making it possible for them to do their work on the ground. So these are pretty tough issues. I'm not sure we're going to get a deal when everything wraps up and the G20 meeting concludes. I suspect that Afghanistan is going to be a challenge going forward, precisely because the countries that have an interest in what happens there disagree on what they want the outcome to be and how to get there.
Yeah, and I think it'll play out whether the conversation gets intensified at the G20 or not. I think it ultimately is going to play out in the UN Security Council in a lot of ways.
And I should also note, Bob, that the Taliban have a vote in how all this turns out. And again, to this point, they have shown very little willingness to give what Western countries have asked for, even at the risk of not getting the aid that the country needs. Okay, Bob, we've reached that point in the show where we pivot to discuss our audience figures of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected FB whistleblower Haugen. Can you give us the background on this choice?
Yes, Jim. Haugen would be Frances Haugen. She was a data scientist at Facebook for about 2 years and had been a veteran of Silicon Valley firms like Google, Yelp, Pinterest, and so forth. At Facebook, one of the things she studied was how its algorithm actually amplified misinformation and was exploited by, in some cases, by foreign adversaries. This past week, she testified before a subcommittee of the U.S. Senate and really, pulled no punches. She said Facebook outright harms children. It contributes to division, undermines democracy, all in the pursuit of, rapid growth and what she called astronomical profits. A real heavy blow, although it should be noted she didn't call for the breakup of Facebook or anything like that, but for sort of stronger oversight and regulation, which is becoming more and more part of the conversation. Although, again, it seems like it's a very kind of elusive topic in Washington. I should also add, Jim, that among the things that came up in her testimony were the implications for rogue regimes using Facebook or for malign elements using Facebook to exploit certain situations. She mentioned Myanmar, for example, where a huge amount of its population uses Facebook and found that Facebook's algorithm was actually promoting posts that violated its own policies about inciting violence, for example, specifically in one case against people who were marching against the coup that the military had mounted back in February. She also noted abuses in the way Facebook's engagement-based ranking was actually contributing to ethnic violence in Ethiopia, where there's a raging civil conflict in the north of that country. She basically said Facebook is not taking the steps it knows it must take to try to cut down on these types of things. And again, it should be noted, internationally, where Facebook is heavily used, there's much less scrutiny and regulation than Facebook is doing in the United States.
So, Bob, what can be done about this? I can't imagine that Congress can write a law directing Facebook to change its algorithms. How do you get out of the situation where you have a company doing things that increase its profits? After all, that's what companies are designed to do, maximize their profits. So what do you do about it?
Yeah, I mean, the big issue now is just that, Jim. And companies across the board, of course, want to maximize profits, but also want to know the rules of the game and want to be able to respond to sort of predictable regulatory environment. Facebook has been on the record, Mark Zuckerberg has been on the record talking about attempts to be a good citizen and so forth. So potentially some sort of effort to sort of create some sort of parameters for Facebook, get Facebook on board, and you know, maybe, and as some people mentioned this week, Jim, maybe just simple steps like what Twitter had started to do, which is that you could not share around an article that you had not read first. Something that simple, some experts say, could cut down quite a bit on people sending around, you know, misinformation or wildly misleading bogus reporting. That seems to have been the case after Twitter started doing that, for example. There's talk about US maybe following the path of what the EU is trying to do with draft legislation in their Digital Services Act that would require the large platforms like Facebook to assess the risk of their algorithms spreading content that affects people's rights, you know, and so, and maybe protecting people from violence, for example. These are small incremental steps, but I think there's a sense that something has to start because there are rampant abuses going on the platform.
I suspect that some of these solutions might be hard to implement in the United States, where you run into First Amendment considerations and the like. I will note that Facebook, like Twitter and a variety of other social media services, have really become an integral way in which we operate. I think that was driven home this week when Facebook and I believe WhatsApp and Instagram went down for several hours. Now, I don't use any of those services myself particularly, but my sense was for a lot of other people, their whole day had been upended. If you want to post your favorite photos to Instagram, you couldn't do it. For many people around the world, rely on WhatsApp to be able to communicate with friends and family because texting is either impossible or prohibitively expensive. So these things are woven into the fabric of everyday lives, and I'm not sure how you reel it back or how you regulate it. I think that's a big challenge for public policy.
You know, it's a really good point. And the WhatsApp point, you know, you just look in our hemisphere, in Latin America, WhatsApp is hugely popular. It's a free service. I saw a stat that a country like Argentina, like 90% usage of WhatsApp for people communicating. They had that taken away for almost 6 hours, and it was a real disruption. It was a major disruption from social to business to, you know, other important uses. So you're right, Jim, you got to be careful on the regulatory side of it, but also be mindful of the too big to fail aspect. Like, are they just too big to do anything at this point?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a big public policy problem, and I'm not sure what the solution is, but I think we're going to have a big discussion about what works and what doesn't.
Well, that's our look at the networked world next week, Jim. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. French President Emmanuel Macron chairs the Africa-France summit. The Nobel Peace Prize winner is announced in Norway, and the Draconid meteor shower lights up the northern sky.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Charlotte Peterson, Maya Kinn, and Rafaela Siebert for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and please stay healthy out there.